and they're just sort of we're all sitting there relaxing and just, you know, watching the harbour go by. And next thing, there's a police launch, screaming sirens and lights and everything screaming towards the boat. And these guys are going, what's going on here?
Hello, folks. Not an audio file, the podcast. This is episode 8, season 1, and today our very special guest is Mr. David Spargo, a highly accomplished acoustician. Very interesting stuff. David has also worked in the recording and music industry, so he has not just knowledge of the technical aspects of that, but some fairly good stories as well. Your background in acoustics is extensive. Where did you get your start with that?
Well, I didn't originally start in acoustics as such. I was always, very early on, I was always fascinated with music and sound. And so that's what I wanted to be involved in as a career. And I played classical guitar, studied classical guitar as I was going through school, but I also started getting really interested in, you know, in sound reproduction and things like that. I was setting up little PA systems in pubs when I was in high school job, just because that sort of thing interested me. And then I studied, after high school, I studied electronics because I thought that was the, you know, a good related business way into music and sound. And after I finished studying, I got my first job was with what was then CBS Records.
Mm-hmm.
In Australia, and I was the maintenance technician in the recording department at the record factory.
Okay, wow.
So I was
servicing, taped, 24-track 2-inch machines or something, or
no, it was all the 2-track material. So it was because it was the record factory. We were just dealing with the mastering.
Doing mastering. Yes. Okay.
Yeah. So.
And the clue is all in the title, really. Record factory.
Yeah,
I wasn't really listening. Okay, so you've got a good grounding in the mastering side of things there, obviously.
Yeah, so I was maintaining all the playback equipment, like mm-hmm. the 2-track tape machines, lots and lots of different types of tape machines there, and all the cutting lathes.
Okay, well, all right.
We were also doing tape, cassette tape mastering as well. So there was a couple of different machines there for cassette tapes. But, it was mostly the vinyl mastering that I was maintaining that chain. And then later I started, doing the mastering myself.
Yeah, okay. Wow. So you skipped floor sweeping and you jumped straight into servicing what now would be the most collectible tape machines on the planet, I guess, because the two-track mastering machines were pretty special, weren't they? Like serious machines.
Oh, yeah. 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 There were some pretty pretty impressive machines there.
Yeah.
And they required constant care, I think we probably had about a dozen different 2-track machines there.
Okay.
That, you know, and you had to align them all at least once a week.
Wow.
So it was you had to constantly work on them.
And so the tapes, okay, so where's the tape coming from? Now, we're going sideways here, but I always wonder about this. So
where does the tape come from?
Where does the tape come from? Is the tape coming from the recording studio? They do a 2 channel or two track mix or something.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Onto half inch tape or something, or what's
No, generally it was onto quarter inch.
Just quarter, okay, yeah. Yeah, but two track only, like divided up. The quarter inch is divided into two tracks only, obviously. Yep.
And, you know, we were getting local stuff plus all the international stuff. So they would, you know, we'd receive lots and lots of tapes every week from all over the world for records that we were going to release.
Yeah.
And they'd all be duplicates. So they'd be, you know, wherever the original masters were created, they would do a whole lot of duplicates and then send them all out to the various factories around the world.
Yeah. Okay. So it's, so it's interesting, isn't it? So we used to talk about, oh, this is an Australian pressing, this is a UK pressing, this is a Japanese pressing. I mean, this is how all that comes about, right? So there's all these different tapes and then effectively different tape machines, which we hope are all, it was your job to maintain to perfection to some degree. And then, and then there's the interpretation of how to deal with that tape and get that into I don't know if the word I'm going to use is correct, but a lacquer, or what are you cutting on the lathe, on the record cutting lathe?
Yeah, so it goes, the tape plays through the electronics of the lathe, the drive system for the stylus on the lathe.
Yeah.
Cuts a lacquer disc. It's basically an aluminium plate.
Yeah.
A lacquer coated aluminium plate.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes on the lathe, and then you get the cutting head cuts that groove into the lacquer.
Okay. And the art when mastering then is to get the levels right, I guess, but there's an EQ aspect, and obviously then there's a real knack to it, I guess. But do you want to throw some color on that a little bit?
What's the point of mastering, David? Could you explain to us what the mastering does?
Well, there's a number of different aspects to mastering, and I guess that sort of over the years, it's the emphasis on certain aspects has changed. I mean, mastering now is different to what you would have considered mastering to be, you know, back when we're making vinyl, you know, a lot of vinyl. So when you make a vinyl record, there's a lot of losses involved. There's a lot of changes that happen to the sound just due to the physical components. So there are a lot of physical processes that have to be done in order to get to that point where you've got a vinyl record.
Indeed.
And so part of that mastering process is to try and compensate for the peculiarities of that transferring sound to that medium. So, for example, the whole reason that we have an RIAA curve is a big part about how the sound excites the stylus in the lacquer. You know, low frequency components, if it wasn't filtered, so if you had a flat frequency response, then the grooves would be, the way the grooves move around would be too extreme.
Yes.
So you have to roll out the bottom end to reduce the amount of movement in the grooves. And at the top end, you increase the top end because it gives you some degree of noise reduction, because the lacquer's not, you know, necessarily completely smooth. So you get a lot of noise in there as well.
Ah, right.
So it's both a way of managing the amount of space that the grooves take up in the low frequency and the amount of noise that they pick up in the high frequency.
Right.
So that's one way. So you've got that RIAA curve is really just there as a way of managing the medium. And you still got to do a lot of work. So when you're mastering doing a vinyl master, you're looking for you're watching it in a microscope while it's being cut.
Wow. Okay. Right. Yeah.
To make sure that there's enough space for the low frequency content, so you're watching that the grooves don't cross over, for example.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Jeez. Or that the stylus doesn't go so deep that it hits the aluminium base.
Yeah.
Things like that.
So when you say lacquer, the disc, the lacquer, is aluminium. But the lacquer is what you're cutting, though. You're not cutting. You're trying to avoid cutting through into the aluminium, like the
aluminium just holds the lacquer. Basically.
And how thick is that lacquer, approximately? Do you think? Not very thick, obviously.
I don't remember, but it's not.
Oh, come on! It was only the other day.
Don't forget he's called Methuselah.
Well, we haven't really told people. I mean, that this was all happening in the '60s. But no, it's not true. I guess this was this late '70s, early '80s, or something? Early '80s, or
early '80s. Yeah,
yeah. And I'm going to guess and say it's, I don't know, 0.25 a mil, if that. I guess is that. I mean, it's pretty. It would appear to be thick when you looked at it, I guess. But the care that you must use to handle these things, because any damage in handling on the lacquer is, I guess, potentially.
It's pretty exacting, and you spend a lot of time inspecting it. There's a bit of guesswork. So one of the things that was always a challenge is that the level and nature of the audio program dictates how long the side can be. So you have to kind of make some adjustments. So if you think that if you think the program length is too long, then you have to reduce the level so that you can fit it in the available space.
Indeed.
Or if the low frequency is, if there's too much low frequency, then you have to use some management tools to sort of reduce the amount of space that it takes up. So one of the things that we commonly did was we had an elliptical filter that progressively reduces the out of phase low frequency content.
Mm-hmm.
Because out of phase content's really difficult to deal with.
Oh, so you kind of mono the bass a bit, kind of.
Yeah, that's right. It progressively monos the bass as you go lower in frequency.
Yep.
Sometimes you get towards the end of the record and go, it's not going to fit.
No shit.
That's a sinking feeling, I guess.
So you throw that lacquer away and start again.
And any thoughts on what a lacquer might have been worth? I mean, it's not like there's people not cutting records now, but I have no idea what a lacquer costs today.
No, I really don't know.
I
never got involved in the accounting side of it. No. I really don't know.
But did you?
Did
you get berated for chucking a few away, or was that,
No, usually you get pretty good at judging this stuff, and you can make adjustments on the way through. So you're watching in the microscope to see how much land you've got between the grooves.
Yes.
And, if you've got adjustments, like you can change the pitch as you run through. So you think, I've got a quiet track here. I can make up a bit of room, so you squeeze the pitch up a bit,
in classical works you'd quiet passages, you'd move the tracks closer together.
You can do
on the fly, kind of thing. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah, as you're cutting.
Yes.
But of course a lot of the EQ that we used to apply was to compensate for the losses in the electroplating process that came afterwards, because things changed during that process.
Mm-hmm.
So we would do a lot of, listening to the final product and comparing it to the to the masters,
mm-hmm.
and trying to work out what EQ we needed to apply to compensate for those changes that always occurred. Because you've got, you know, several electroplating stages between the lacquer and the...
A lot of subjective evaluation going on there, just going through that stage, and that's not even the mastering stage, correct? Or is that what you call mastering?
Well, that's kind of what we call mastering for that process, but I guess, you know, another part of mastering is to... which is probably more what people refer to mastering now, is to, you know, create a two-track program that is loud enough, or, you know, has the right spectral balance, or, you know, so a lot of the time, you know, people might be concerned with how it sounds on how a particular track sounds on radio, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've got some reference for how you think that should sound, then you can change whatever program you presented with to better conform with what you think is the desired sound for radio, for example.
But sorry to interrupt, and want to come back to it, so I don't want to, but so back in the 70s, 80s or 90s, when they were doing the mastering then, were they still, well, obviously looking at it from a radio point of view for a hi-fi system at home, and, you know, is it different from now? Would it be, you know, with LP to sort of say digital?
It's probably not that different, really. I think that when we were cutting vinyl, for example, particularly the local material would come in straight from the studio, and then we would make kind of, I guess, artistic adjustments to the way it sounds to to our ears. You know, we were the final stop before people got to listen to that program material. So we were applying compression and EQ, and sometimes, you know, as new pieces of equipment came out, like oral exciters, for example, we were applying those types of effects in that mastering stage as well. Not so much in the international stuff that was coming through, because that was that had already gone through that stage at in another mastering room somewhere. But I think the whole concept of mastering is that, you know, when you do a mix in a studio, and it's probably even much more important today because studios are not as standard as they used to be. So it's very rare these days to get a really good sounding studio. A really good sounding control room, because people just don't seem to understand or care about, dare I say, the importance of a really good sounding control room. And don't forget, a lot of people are producing stuff in their living rooms or bedrooms as well, so, you know, they don't have less than optimal reference capability in those rooms. So, you know, once you've finished your mix, you send it off to a mastering engineer who theoretically is listening in a highly refined listening room and can make critical judgments about how it sounds, you know, final judgments about how it sounds and how it's going to be presented to the audience.
Yeah.
So I think, in a way, mastering's probably even more important today than it was, you know, when I started doing it in the early 80s.
Right.
Because we just don't have so many great studios around anymore. And those mixes are not finished to the same degree that they might have been in a better sounding studio.
Yeah, I feel like in the mid 80s which maybe is the, I don't know, peak of the analog era, that the tapes you received to turn into records would be pretty close. I would guess. Yeah, I mean the local product. I mean the ones that were created locally. But I mean, obviously the imports, as you say, the tapes were largely already an optimised. That was the sound they wanted anyhow, I guess. And you just turn this into a record if you could, please, sir. I think is what they were, I guess, asking you to do. But obviously it was a little bit more creative control locally. But you're saying that they were pretty good.
Well, we used to have quite a lot of quite good quality studios. Certainly all of the record companies had very good studios.
Yes.
So you had, you know, Castlereagh Street was EMI's sort of flagship. This Festival Records had a really good studio in Piemont.
Yeah.
There were a lot of really good studios around.
Sony? Was there Sony as well?
Sony. Well, Sony was the studio that I ended up managing and running. It was a demo studio, but it was a very good quality demo studio. So we had a lot of really important acts coming through that studio. But we generally didn't do album work in there. It was more of a writing studio.
Okay.
Oh, okay. So EMI and Festival, those guys did.
Yeah, they were all finished, you know, finished products. Some pretty good recordings came out of those places. Oh, but I'm
pretty sure that
You just don't have that quality of studio around anymore. Very few of them around.
Why is that, do you think, David? I mean, obviously the music business has, I guess, not got as much money washing through it as it used to have. But
But that's certainly a big factor. Yeah,
that's a big factor. Okay.
Yeah. But also people don't feel it's necessary. It's very difficult for me to say whether this is, you know, a good or a bad thing, because I'm a bit biased towards the, you know, what I kind of grew up with.
Yeah, of course.
But I certainly hear it in the recordings. You hear recordings from the 70s and 80s where the recordings are immaculate.
Mm.
And you really just don't hear that anymore, or very, very seldom. They have a different quality. I mean, I still enjoy recordings, contemporary recordings, but they just don't sound the same.
Sound more digital or something, or what? How would you describe it? Do you think, or characterize it?
I don't. No, actually, I haven't really thought about how I would characterise it, perhaps.
Well, if you're talking about from that period, the recording from the 70s and 60s, 70s and 80s or 50s, then you're also potentially would have been listening to it on a turntable as well. Can you tell, say, if you're listening to a CD or via streaming, that something's been done a certain way back in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and you can still hear that quality through a CD player.
Yeah, I don't think it matters what the medium is. I think you can hear the quality.
Yeah, I mean, agreed with that.
Some of it could have been like how clean everything was. So, you know, recording engineers were very focused on, you know, getting the recordings right. So you had very good, you know, clean signals, and there was often a lot of space, so everyone was really careful to sort of like, you know, allow everything to have its space, particularly where you're dealing with effects and, you know, not layering effects too much.
Right.
So you can hear the essence of what's being recorded and reproduced, rather than, you know, a mash of everything giving an impression. Right.
I guess to some degree, its fashion has changed, I guess, to some degree. But
well, certainly there is an oral fashion, and there was an interesting study done in the States some years back where university students were given two recordings of two recordings of the same material. So it was like some pieces of music that were presented in an analog format,
yeah,
one, and in a you know, an MP3 perceptually encoded format.
Yeah.
And the question was just simply, which one do you prefer?
Yes.
And most of the college age students preferred the MP3.
Uh-oh.
Because that's what they're used to.
Oh, okay.
It wasn't anything to do with the quality of the recording or anything. It was simply what they were used to.
Hmm.
So we're
doomed.
Yeah. So it's just a different aesthetic, oral aesthetic, that people are looking for. So, you know, mastering is really, you know, catering for that as well. Apart from the other, you know, the obvious technical aspects, like, you know, if you're going, particularly with digital, you want everything to be as loud as possible without distortion, because, you know, digital is the resolution at high levels is much better than the resolution at low levels. So, you know, which is back to front from analog. So, you know, you want everything as loud as it possibly can be without actually exceeding the limits. So that's one of the functions of modern mastering, is just to make sure that that's the case.
And does that involve maybe applying a bit of compression to keep everything up there in the higher resolution levels?
Yeah, well, that, and of course, the more compression you have, the louder it sounds.
Yeah.
So, yes, compression. But often you'll go through the whole recording and, you know, pick the loudest spot and then adjust the level just so that that loudest part fits into the available data, you know?
Yes, yeah. Just wind back for a sec. So you've got the... I just want to clarify something. I'm not sure everyone kind of understands the process. So the lathe cuts the lacquer. The lacquer is then electroplated in some way, like chrome-plated or effectively?
Generally, it's silver. You do a layer of silver.
Okay,
first,
yeah.
And then a layer of nickel.
Yeah, right, yeah, yeah.
Which, you know, gives it the integrity. So the silver layer is very thin.
Yeah.
And then you put nickel on that. So that's the first process, and you get what's called a father off the lacquer.
Okay.
And it's a negative.
Hmm.
Then you do another process where you more or less do the same thing again, but you develop a mother, which is a playable positive copy.
Yes,
so
yep.
Generally we would play the mother just to make sure that there were no faults in it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you make off the mother, you make stampers, so you'll make a bunch of copies off the mother.
Yeah.
And then those stampers, which are negative parts, go into the presses.
Yeah, literally squashing the vinyl.
Yep.
That's, yeah, thanks for laying that out, because I think I knew that once, but I'd long forgotten.
A really good pricey.
And what do you think, I know this is the loaded old guys question, but, you know, these new guys that make records, any good?
I wouldn't presume to criticize people like that. I think, as I said before, there's still a valid mastering, you know, still a valid reason for mastering.
Mm-hmm.
And that to me, I mean, I don't work in mastering these days, but to me, that's more about the availability of good quality listening rooms.
Yeah.
I think you really need to, you need, as a final stage in any sound production, you need to go through some sort of standard listening room where you've got a you know, a pretty good reference for what things are going to sound like.
Kind of makes sense.
I mean, I did an album once in I recorded and mixed an album in a room that I didn't know very well.
Mm.
on a system that I didn't know very well, and it was a kind of a rush job, so I didn't get a lot of sort of luxury time to fiddle around with it. But I mixed to two track and then took it into a mastering room to check it, and it was the whole recording was pervaded with a it was just muddy. The whole thing was muddy.
Okay.
And I couldn't hear that in the studio that I was working in. I just couldn't hear it at all.
No, because you were using those bloody JBLs.
I think we were using some sort of small...
Ah, okay, little near-field type thing.
Yeah. A
pair of those Yamahas. things.
I wouldn't have minded Yamahas, but... Because I know them.
Yes,
in those days I knew them quite well. But
yeah.
No, it was something. It was something that I wasn't familiar with.
Yeah, okay.
And I missed it in the mix process. I just mixed the fact that the sound that I was mixing was quite muddy. So it had to be compensated in mastering. Mm. And I simply wasn't aware of it until it went into mastering. And that's a
bloody hell.
You know, that's a perfect example of what mastering's really there for.
Yeah, and I guess putting the oomph back into it, it's not great for the noise floor or something. You weren't in a position to go back and remix it or
No, I wasn't.
Oh, because you said it was a bit of a rush job. Yep.
Yeah, and it's less than ideal to have to try and compensate for that sort of thing, because you're actually cutting stuff that you actually it's part of what you want as well.
Yes, yeah.
So, but, you know, it turned out okay in the end, but, you know, it was a really good example of why you need good reference listening rooms.
Yeah, I mean, it was only
you want those control rooms to be as good as possible.
It was only a split Anzel Mini, so it doesn't really matter. So, it's just Kiwi crap. So you must have. So who the hell did you work with? You must have. You must be able to impress us with a couple of salubrious bands.
Characters.
Well, I celebrities. During my time at CBS Records, it was bought by Sony, so I ended up working for Sony Music.
Mm-hmm.
And I progressed from the record plant to the head office and built and ran the studio there.
Yeah.
So we had a writing studio. So as I said, I used to get a lot of artists coming in and writing there. So they would often spend quite a bit of time in the studio preparing for album recordings, for example.
Yeah.
So I worked with quite a lot of people. I did a lot of work with Midnight Oil.
Okay.
So they came in and did writing, so it was like about 3 months at a time for three albums. So I ended up,
Jesus, wept.
Spending a lot of time
with
those guys. We actually did an album with Eurogliders.
Oh, yeah.
In the studio. They wanted to record the album in the studio, so we did that.
Which album was that, as a matter of interest?
That was...
Not the one with Heaven on it, the one after.
No, the one after.
Yeah. That's good recording, that album.
What was it called?
Oh, I've forgotten what it's called, but it's a goodie.
I'm sorry, Bernie and Grace, I can't remember the name of it at the moment.
And I can't remember it either, and I've got a copy. But, that's a good album. Pretty lively sort of recording, but sounds nice. And anyone else you care to...
Look, there were lots of people. I had I can't remember. Noiseworks, we used to have a band. Noiseworks were in there a lot. Did quite a lot of session work too. We used to do quite a lot of advertising work in downtime because they were quick jobs.
Yeah.
But used to get some amazing session musicians come in for those jobs, so that was really good.
So were you doing the margarine ad, so you ought to be congratulated and, or whatever, or something associated, or, you know, Come on, Aussie, come on.
Yeah, look, we used to do stuff. So we used to just hire out to advertising agencies, and they would bring in their own production people and just run through. But they were usually only, you know, 2-3 day jobs because recording, you know, a 60-second
jingle,
you know, jingle or something like that. Yeah. But I used to do, I don't know, there was some spoken word stuff. Actually, I recorded, so we've spoken about Neville Teal a bit. I mean,
well, we were going to have a quick break and get on to Neville Teal, but I thought I'd.
Oh, but you hold on. Sorry, Andrew.
But I wanted to hear celebrity sightings first. I'm really desperate.
Just one thing. Were you going to mention Neville Teal's acting brother?
Yes, I was.
Right, go ahead.
So Leonard, I think it's Leonard Teal.
It is Leonard Teal.
Hang on a minute. So you're telling me Neville Teal was the brother of Leonard?
Yeah.
Homicide actor.
I'm an idiot.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
I'm an idiot. Really?
That's right.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Wow. What a voice.
Both of them started in acting. Neville was an actor as well in his early days.
Is that a fact?
And but Neville became more interested in the engineering side of it, so he sort of left it. But Leonard just went on, you know, continued doing it to the, you know, his whole life. But he used to come in and do poetry.
Yeah, I remember that.
Recordings. Yeah. So I recorded quite a lot of
The Man from Snowy River, etc.
That's right. That's right. And that was sort of
I Love a Sunbird Country.
So he used to do those kinds of things as well. He was great.
You had two rubs of the teal, so to speak.
Yes, yeah.
Not sure what that means, but it's. And which brother did you? Even though we're going to come back to Neville, but which brother did you? I guess you met Neville first, or knew Neville?
No, I actually met Leonard first.
Oh, is that right? Okay, all right.
Yeah. So I met Leonard quite early on in my career and did a bit of work with him, and it wasn't until much later that I met Neville.
Okay. Geez, that family was kicking some goals, weren't they?
Yeah.
Jesus, yeah.
We're going to move on from the recording studio stuff, but you have to give us one hot story. Celebrity,
yeah, you got to
give us,
even a couple.
Maybe you can leave a name out or something to make it. But
can we pixelate it? We might pixelate it.
Audio pixelate it, but
audio pixelate it. Yeah.
I mean, there's. It doesn't. I don't know.
Must be rampant stories.
The last time I was talking to someone in the music industry, I asked them the same question. They said, "Look, I can't really say, but." And it was someone who worked at EMI, and it was really just someone who he had to hold up in the lift as they went down after a session because it was so off his tits.
Yeah.
Basically, he had worn himself out, I guess.
So he's fruited right.
And that story becomes much more interesting when you know who it was, which we're not saying. But you may have something juicy, David. Fire away.
Look, there's lots of stories, but I, you know, when you put me on the spot, that's sort of I don't know which ones I could tell and which ones I can't, sort of thing.
David, is it okay to prompt and you sort of swat it to the side or say, no, I'll take that one on. What about the story? No, you've regaled one or two without names.
Well, there was that time on that boat, on that harbour cruise, but we're not talking about that.
A boat cruise or something.
Yes.
Well, we don't have to name the what happened?
The one on the boat.
The one on the boat.
Yeah.
So we had a very prominent international act to Australia at one stage.
Okay.
And
what style of music did this prominent act perform?
Do we need to go there?
Mate,
classical musician.
Oh, God. Classical musician.
The Russian symphony or something like that, they like to go off.
Let's just say it was an extremely famous entertainer.
Okay.
often went international because I was working at the head office at Sony. We would often do parties and, you know, functions for the visiting artists. So, and I, because I was on the technical side, I was always really heavily involved in, you know, getting everything happening. So I was always, you know, in the organizing group. And so this one particular artist had, we were taking them out on a harbour cruise, and which was a favourite one because it, you know, good looking harbour in Sydney. Oh, yeah. And you know, people like doing that. So anyway, but they wouldn't get on the boat with everyone else. They had to have a special stop where we went and picked them up.
Okay.
And
right.
Was there sort of a
the grand entry,
yeah, and everyone had to be there. But the interesting thing with this one was that usually it was just executives and people like that that would go on this, but this particular artist had said that it would be nice to have for people to bring their kids along.
Oh, he wanted lovely. He wanted them to. Yeah. He wanted everyone to bring their children along. Okay,
bring their children along. Yeah, yeah. So like, let's make it a family event. So okay. Everyone brought their little kids along. Right. Now, so there was a boat full of, you know, parents and children, basically.
Okay.
Oh, lovely.
And so anyway, when this person got on the boat, they came down to the, like the boat, where everyone was at the, you know, on a lower deck in the boat, and there was a stairway. So this artist got on the boat on a upper deck and walked down the stairs, and there was a big kind of entrance, and everyone was standing around waiting. And then one of the kids that was one of the executive's little boys, who was about, I don't know, must have been about 5 or 6, was a particularly precocious little
fellow.
Yeah.
Yeah, ahead of his time.
Ran up to this poor bloke at the bottom of the stairs. And then stood there with his hands on his hips, staring him in, you know, eyeballing him.
Yes.
And so he's bent down to go, oh, hello, who are you? And he's just punched him in the stomach.
Just a clarification.
This little kid punched him in the stomach.
The very important musical celebrity in the stomach.
Yeah. Wow. Luckily, it wasn't any lower. I mean, that would be... But he must have hit him in the solar plexus. What happened then?
Can you... Well,
oh, he doubled over and kind of everyone just... There was just this gasp.
Silence.
From everybody, you know. And I was standing right beside him. I was standing right beside the stairs because... That was my kind of technical position, was it?
Can you do an impression of the musician that we're speaking of when he bent over to ask the little boy what he was up to? Can you do the voice a little bit?
No, I can't. But anyway, he handled it very graciously, and you know, to much to everyone's relief, he was
he was alive.
Okay, about it, yeah. But it was, yeah, it was.
He handled it with aplomb.
Mm.
Yeah.
As an aside, was he quite a was he like to get along with? For those that can guess who it might have been, was he? I mean, because he seemed quite aloof, but. But you were standing next to him, and I guess you did. You help him up? Did you? Did you dare?
No,
did
I didn't.
You deigned to touch him.
For me, it was a bit of a dilemma whether you know, I was should have done that or not. But,
now,
anyway, David, he handled it.
You tell the truth. I think David crash tackled the little boy. I think that must have happened. Surely.
No, I didn't.
No.
The parent stepped in and kind of.
Oh, God, imagine the parent.
And did they? The parents apologise for the behaviour of the child?
Oh, yeah, look, there was a lot of profuse apologies. And
I bet there was.
Things like that, but it didn't detract at all from the hilarity of the situation.
The hilarity, I guess, happened sometime later after the guest had once again gone to the upper deck and jumped off at another dock.
Well, yeah, because it all ended well, it was hilarious. But you know, I guess it could have been different. But, I've always found that the biggest, almost always the biggest artists are the most humble, actually, in their the way they deal with people.
Yeah,
it's usually the smaller sort of up and coming people who are can be a bit of a handful.
Yeah.
A bit of pomp and circumstance, bit of right.
And the I guess that child is now I don't know 30 odd years of age, and I wonder if they go around.
boasting.
Basically, you wouldn't believe what I did when I was a child. All right. Well, there is a competition, folks. If you know who we're speaking of, don't put it in the comments because we won't confirm or deny. And that's, the comments, by the way, are best entered into on our YouTube channel, Not an Audiophile. And there's two YouTube channels called Not an Audiophile. We're the newest one, and it's Not an Audiophile podcast. But anyhow, you'll find us. It's the standard logo. But yeah, you could make comments there, and we may conjure up a prize, maybe a pair of Sirhan and Swift Mewtwo speakers or something like that, if Brad's feeling generous. Probably not. That's a joke prize. But yeah, thank you, David. That story is I guess, for Brad and more entertaining. We know who it is.
Isn't there another nautical one, David, as well? Or we
see the other nautical one that you mentioned the other day. I believe you can say who that was because they don't exist anymore.
I'm not sure, but
I mean, when I say they don't exist anymore, they no one cares.
Jesus!
Oh, I don't know about that.
It's a funny tale.
It's a good tale, but to just call it sort of a rock band. Is that what you call
it?
It's a generic rock band.
It kind of is a generic American rock act from the 80s and, well, mostly the 80s, so 70s and 80s.
And that pretty much narrows it down, doesn't it, really? So you could pretty well guess that whatever.
Narrows it right down,
this generic rock band. Again, it was a harbour cruise. So,
nighttime
harbour cruise.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it was around Christmas time, so it was a really warm night. And we were all standing on the top of the boat. There was a top deck. And these guys were hankering for a joint. And they were asking me if it was like okay if they could have a joint, you know, so like what the rules are around here and all that sort of stuff. And I said, look, you know it's illegal right here, but I don't think anyone's gonna have a problem with you if you wanted to have a joint up here on the boat. It's not gonna bother anyone, it's all cool.
Yeah, it's out in the harbour, isn't it? Jesus.
Yeah. So they went, oh, great.
Not like the cops are going to, be around or anything. So.
Yeah, you're on a boat. It's quite isolated, right?
Yeah.
So they've had their joint and they're just sort of we're all sitting there relaxing and watching the harbour go by. And next thing, there's a police launch, screaming sirens and lights and everything screaming towards the boat. And these guys are going, what's going on here? And I didn't think too much of it, but it just kept coming towards the boat.
I love the fact you were so calm.
And I'm thinking, this is a bit odd.
Yeah.
And anyway, they really got scared and they just emptied their pockets over the side of the boat.
Sounds like they had a lot of stuff.
There was a bit. And, everyone was a bit upset. And the boat and the police launch pulled up alongside. We stopped, and the police launch pulled up alongside the our boat.
Mm-hmm.
And then a guy got off the police launch dressed as Santa Claus with a sack full of...
with a whole bunch of reefers. No, sorry, go ahead.
And it turns out it was just the state manager had a couple of mates in the water police, and they were just doing a, you know, Santa Claus stunt for Christmas.
And I thought it would be hilarious.
Yeah.
Oh, Jesus.
And I guess it was at the end, but, you know, there was some tense moments there for a while.
And the generic American rock band were obviously in the market for some more weed at that point.
Yes, I think so. I don't think they had much trouble getting it. But.
No.
Yeah.
All righty. Thank you, David, for that. We will take a break, and we will be back to briefly discuss, or maybe at length discuss, Neville Teal and the fact that you you replaced him, basically. So we'll talk some.
Well, yeah, in a very marginal way.
Yeah, yeah. We'll cover that. All right. Don't go anywhere, anybody. We'll be right back. Andrew here, talking yet again about various products that we might sell or services that we may perform. But most importantly, this has been recorded just days before the Australian Melbourne Stereo Net Hi-Fi show held in the Pullman Hotel next to the lake in Albert Park in Melbourne. And if I sound a little worn out, I think I have. I've been preparing for the show for... It feels like months, but it's really only weeks. But getting everything together and turning up at these shows, and in our case, showing off our loudspeaker models with assistance from Alex from Audio Fix Distribution with his electronics, Exposure Electronics and EAR Yoshino, is quite a project to get it all together. And, of course, there's 30 other or more rooms to see at the show, some large, some small. Ours are small, but it's good, of course. Great, even. But yeah, you should come and have a look. The people who show up with their gear have actually made an enormous amount of effort. I guess coming from Queensland, we make even more effort because we have to get it further and get ourselves further. But be assured, the exhibitors at these shows are trying very hard to put on a great show, and it's well worth coming and seeing what they have on offer. It's certainly a great way to spend probably almost a weekend. I don't think you can get around the show in a day, so do allow some time. So we're in 2204. Unsurprisingly, on the second floor, I believe, judging by that number, and easy to get to up the lift. And come and have a chat, have a listen. We've got our new model, 70S. And later in the show, or whenever you finish listening, please like, subscribe, and follow using whatever method is best to give some support to the podcast and give us the enthusiasm to continue on into, what'll be a new year soon. So thanks again for listening, and now back to the rest of the show with David. So, not an audiophile, the podcast. We're back with David Spargo and Brad Serhan and myself, Andrew Hutchison, discussing, the good old days, as usual. But we're also going to cover some acoustic stuff now. And, David, at some point, I guess, you got or moved sideways from recording and somehow you... I mean, we've already found out that you, in fact, knew Leonard Teal before you knew Neville Teal, and that Leonard Teal, unbeknownst to me, was Neville Teal's brother, and we're both in acting initially. And so how did you meet Neville? How did that all come about, and why did you move sideways into the more technical, theoretical aspects of sound reproduction?
I did studio production, and then, you know, moved into live production as well for a long time. And then I had been working in a number of studios, and I started to notice that my hearing, in a nutshell, I was getting tinnitus.
Okay.
And at that stage, I compare it to, like, you know, when you discover that you need to start wearing glasses, it's like you go through this period of, you know, denial and, you know, resistance and catastrophe and all this sort of stuff. And I did that when I started realizing that I wasn't hearing quite the same way as I used to, and I kind of catastrophized over that and went, well, that's the end of my production career.
Sounding a little petulant, like one of your artists.
Yeah, and so I really was thinking, well, how do I move on from here? And I'd always been really interested in why different studios that I worked in had particular sounds, because most studios have quite a distinctive signature sound,
mm-hmm.
except for the very good ones, which don't have a distinctive sound. But most rooms have quite a distinctive sound, and I was always fascinated about why that was, and didn't really have the knowledge to answer that question. So I thought, maybe that's what I should be doing.
Mm-hmm.
So I started studying and okay. went to Sydney University and studied. I did a master's degree in audio and sound and audio,
mm-hmm.
acoustics.
Yeah.
That's where I met Neville.
Okay.
Because he was a honorary associate professor there.
Okay.
And he was doing a loudspeaker course there. So he taught loudspeaker design.
What year? Because this is not that long ago, is it? This is, I mean, it is.
No.
I mean, if you're 20, it's ages ago. But if you're middle-aged, this is what, in the 90s or?
No. This was in the 2000s.
Oh, so crikey. That's what I was thinking. It's not, yeah.
I think I would have started for the master's degree, I would have started in about 2001, I think.
Okay, yeah.
Something like that. And he was teaching there, so I did his loudspeaker course in, I don't know, sometime during that decade. I really can't remember when it was, but it might have been, 2006 or something like that.
Wow. I mean, what a great thing.
Wow, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, why weren't you there, Brad? Oh, that's right, you taught Neville. It's true, isn't it? It's just an amazing thing. I mean, the guy at this joint was, I don't know, was he 60 or 70 or how?
Oh, no, he was in his late 80s.
He was in his late
80s. Amazing.
Oh, hang late on, yes. I'm forgetting that he's not been around for a few years. Yeah, so he's in his late 80s.
Mm.
What a joy. And he was as sharp as, I guess you're going to tell us.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And he was still churning papers out right up until the point where he passed away.
Okay. And when you say right up to the point, you mean?
Like up to the day.
Up to the day.
Just gobsmacking.
He was.
His mind was still, oh my.
Yeah, he was sitting in hospital with a laptop.
Wow. Trying
to finish papers off.
That's
just wonderful.
Yeah. Mm. Wow.
Wonderful.
Such an incredible.
So that course. Sorry,
human. Andrew. No. Go back to the course, Brad. Yeah, the brand that you'd.
Oh no! Just amazed. Outlined. So there was no such course back in the late 70s or 80s. But the fact that someone like Neville Teal was there, doing the course, and I know that you did it, and I know another mate of mine, James Galloway, did it, and who else do we know? Neil, your mate Neil Rule.
Oh, yeah.
There's quite a few people that did the course, and Greg Long, a dear mate of mine who owned a hi-fi shop as a mechanical engineer, went and did that course and loved it.
How intense was it, David? Was it like it was pretty weighty or...?
Yeah, there was a lot of, Neville was trying to explain all of his, development of all his theory and mathematics and,
yep.
The whole design.
just everything he knew, he was basically trying to pass on.
Yeah, he was just, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
And so it was quite, you know, there was a lot there. There was a lot to it. Plus, he was a really interesting guy, too. So he was, you know, very happy to tell stories about how all this stuff came about. And,
wow. Okay.
Probably one of the interesting things I found was that he was actually in the army for quite a long time, and he was an engineer in the army.
Right.
And he said that he developed a lot of the base theory for loudspeaker design. He developed while he was stationed in New Guinea.
Okay.
During the Second World War, and he wasn't doing very much a lot of the time. So he said he just sat on the beach and worked all the mathematics out.
Okay. Right. It's not a, not
and
a,
then,
not
and a, then after, oh, wow. after
you certainly have a clear head, war. Except there was a war going on, I guess, but
but it didn't impact him a lot at the time. So, when he was working for other companies after the war, he started applying a lot of that stuff in design. So I think he worked at, was it AWA or?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
I don't know, some of those companies where designing loudspeakers for radiograms and things like that.
Judging by my experience with AWA radiograms, they obviously put a pretty tight budget on his developments, because
well, that might be the wrong company, but it was.
I'm certainly some not, of those early. I'm not meaning that seriously, but the point is that he worked in the industry as it was in this country at that point, and then he obviously started working at the uni, I guess, or you know, obviously became.
Well, he worked at a lot of places. He was working in the R&D department or the engineering department of ABC for quite a long time as well.
Yeah, okay, yep.
Right.
So he did they were doing loudspeaker stuff as well. They were interested in that. But, you know, he was an engineer. He was essentially an electrical engineer.
Yeah, so. Okay, yeah. But his personal favourite hobby obviously was, I guess, was loudspeakers. That was his, yeah. So,
definitely.
So I'm still impressed with the fact that you could do a course under him, or you know, that's quite something. How long did that go for? A couple of years or so, or is it, or did it was packaged no, it was down
a,
to?
So it was a part time. So all of the courses in the master's degree that I did were part time.
Okay.
So you could usually they were nighttime courses, but
yep.
Neville didn't like doing the nighttime stuff, so it was always a daytime.
Okay.
And that was one of the difficulties. I think the courses were not particularly well attended because they were usually on a Friday afternoon.
Yeah, okay.
Sort of, you know, early afternoon, and most people couldn't get time off work to attend the courses. So they were usually very small cohorts for those courses. And it was a one semester course, so it was like, I think we were doing 13 weeks, I think.
Yep, okay. So it was pretty intense.
A lot crammed in.
Yeah.
Yeah, weeks. And there was a lot of homework. And,
I bet there was.
So he would try and explain as much as he could about stuff in a, you know, three-hour lecture.
Yes.
And then we'd have, you know, massive assignments to do for the next week.
And some of those assignments were practical things, I guess, were they? Where you had to cobble together your own design or something based on?
He did do that in a few years, but not in the year that I did.
Okay.
Because he said it always proved to be too difficult to manage.
Okay.
So it was all theory. When I did it, it was just theory.
Okay. Still, what an experience. You know, that's great stuff. And so you ended up, as I understand it, teaching at said university. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So I was doing.
So you've done everything, right? Like you just, there's no end.
I call him Bam, Andrew.
Bam.
Big Audio Methuselah. Bam. he's actually 1,000 years of age. Good on you, Bam. Bam, Bam.
So you did teaching. You had to do a teaching course, obviously. Although if you can wrangle musicians, you probably can wrangle students, I guess, right?
No, when you do higher education, the level that you achieve is sort of entitles you to teach anyway. So you don't have to do
a excuse my lack of understanding of academia. I'm a tradesman only. So you start teaching the acoustics that you learnt under Neville and other lecturers.
Yeah, I was doing some teaching of acoustics and I co-presented Neville's course the year after he decided that he couldn't do it anymore.
Yeah. Okay. Yep.
Which was a daunting experience.
When you say co,
sat in the classroom
So he goes,
Neville sat in the classroom.
That would be daunting. Doing him justice.
So he asked you. He said, "Well, David, you can take this course over because you know you've got the skills for this." And by the way, I'll be sitting up the back taking notes.
Yeah.
Oh dear.
Yeah, it was quite intimidating. But
so there was you and Dr. Denzel Cabrera as well, wasn't there?
That's right, yes.
Would he sit in Denzel's as well?
Yes, yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's good. The students must have felt reassured that they had the rear guard, the big audio rear guard there.
He could interject at any time and go, no, that's not right. That's not how you do it.
And did he?
No.
Because David's always right. I'm happy to say that.
He's a gentleman.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, in a sense, he was there just to, psychologically assist. That's one.
Yeah, that's right.
Chaperone.
I mean, sometimes we would defer or, you know, ask him to contribute to the class.
Okay.
Yeah.
But generally it wasn't, you know, he wouldn't interject.
Yeah. And yeah,
that's incredible. Actually, that's such a joy to hear that. That's wonderful.
We didn't really cover this, but I mean, he was, as a human, he was a great bloke is what you're saying, David.
Yeah. He was a lovely man.
Yeah. Okay. Wow.
Very humble. Yep. Very, very likable character.
Wow, and for those listening who really are wondering who we are talking about, I mean, Neville Teal is the T in TS parameters. So
Teal Small.
Yeah, Teal Small parameters, which, you know, is all about, well, I mean, one, that part of his work is about predicting bass alignments, but he did wrote many papers, obviously.
Yes, I think he's got over, I don't know, he wrote some 40 papers.
Yeah.
In his lifetime, about loudspeakers, crossovers, various other things.
Mm. Yeah, quite an incredible amount of work. So, I guess to wrap on your theoretical acoustic side, and then we might pass on to some advice and how you might advise listeners to improve their room. Right, we might snip the episode there and call that the end of part one of the David Spargo interview. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it as interesting as I have. The guy is a genius and the stories are amazing, and there's more to come in part two, mostly about room acoustics. Now, if you've enjoyed the podcast, and we're hoping you have, please like, follow, subscribe on the whatever way you're listening to it, whether it be Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, what have you. And of course, feel free to make comments on the YouTube listings for the episodes. But yeah, if you follow us, it just keeps the whole thing rolling along. And at this stage, I can't imagine being any more enthusiastic. it's a joy to interview people like David, who have such a broad range of knowledge and, in this case, some pretty interesting experiences, and obviously worked with and under some amazing people. So, yeah, back with the second episode in a couple of weeks. Thanks for listening again, and that's a wrap for today.